This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Sendung Wellenlänge. Vous écoutez la transmission longueur d'onde. Udite la trasmissione lunghezza d'onde. You are hearing the transmission called wavelength.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And today's guest is Roger Burton. Good afternoon, Roger. Thank you for coming in.
Good afternoon, William. What was that ticking clock? There used to be something called Time to Remember. On the TV,
Edgar Lustgarten.
Time to Remember, and that there always had the ticking clock
Did
at the
they?
Beginning.
Okay.
Anyway, sorry.
Yes, no, that's all right. Now, this particular clock was in Syston. It was a fairly. What do you call those clocks? You're a bit of
Westminster Chime.
Well, it wasn't a grandfather clock, but what was a grandmother clock?
A smaller version of a grandfather clock.
But did it also stand on the floor?
Yes.
Ah, well, this was one of those that was like a sort of
like
cabinet,
a
cabinet like that that hung on the wall. And it was in Sandy's parents' house in Syston, near Leicestershire, where we both hark from, which could be
indeed
a point of conversation. And in fact, the clock was awarded to Sandy's grandfather for coming sixth in a cross-country marathon way back when. Yes, interesting you picked up on that. But nobody ever does. Of course, it chimes 11, so it's sort of like the chimes of doom. It's like we're at the 11th hour, you see. That's it. So you might also have recognised the coughing, or perhaps not.
No, was it?
Well, that was Hugh.
Oh, right, okay.
Hugh de la Cruz.
Yes, indeed.
Who used to wash up at the dining room.
Yes, okay.
And was also the subject of a film which you came to.
In fact,
you are a regular visitor to my films. Thank you very much for your loyalty.
I try.
That was in It's My Own Invention. Not that he coughs in It's My Own Invention. And then, of course, we went into Maurice Seddon.
The
voice of Morris.
I always remember him in your dining room and talking about his Rolls Royce. And how long was it, Morris? And he would pace it out. It was about as long as the counter, I remember. Pacing these, like, jack boots, you know, pacing these steps out.
Yes.
18 metres or something.
Of course, you would have met him. And in fact, it's interesting because, of course, the dining room was in this neck of the woods. Borough High Street, indeed, which you know well, but I don't know if you ever ventured down this part of Borough High Street at that time. Would you have done?
Yeah, I used to occasionally come to the pub, the old Dickens pub.
Oh, you know, is it the George? Possibly the George in the courtyard.
Yeah, the one that's all preserved with minstrels' galleries and stuff.
Yes, right, okay.
Occasionally used to go there.
Yeah.
But of course, that would be late 70s, early 80s,
right.
When Borough Market was still a market.
Yeah,
and I used to sleep on the floor of a warehouse space, the top floor in the freezing cold.
Right. Why did you sleep on the floor?
Because I was still living up in Leicestershire.
Ah.
Trading down here with hiring out my clothes to film and TV and music video and stuff. And we had this space on the third floor of something called New Hibernia House in
Winchester Walk.
Winchester Walk in Borough Market.
Yes.
And the people below us, it was quite an interesting building, actually, eventually, because we were really the first sort of different sort of thing to move into Borough Market after the fruit and veg people, who, of course, were there all night.
Yes.
And we were there during the day because it was normally quiet empty during the day. But the there was a few interesting businesses in that building.
I think we have to mention Andrew Chazowski, I think.
Of course, Andrew Chazowski of the Roxy fame, yes.
Yeah. Who was a sort of estate agent of sorts, was he?
He's all, bless Andrew, I love him.
Yes, but, hello, Andrew.
I don't know, he was very into making a bit of money.
Yes.
Other than being an accountant, and he's most well known for the Roxy Club on Neal Street, which was the first punk club. And
so he was the landlord of that.
He was the landlord of a couple of buildings in Borough Market. He took on these buildings because they were cheap and let them out to his mates, basically.
Yes, which he wasn't supposed to do, of course.
No.
It was all a bit irregular and you had to just go with it.
Indeed.
And he'd say, "I'll give you a piece of paper," which never appeared. Yeah. And that was supposed to be your sort of contract.
The contract, yes.
Which made it sort of legal, but never did.
Yeah. No.
As a consequence of that, because I came to... You started... Well, Contemporary Wardrobe was there, although this was a slight point of contention because it sounds like it started in Belgravia, but anyway, it doesn't really matter.
Mm.
You moved to Hibernia House, or New Hibernia House.
Yeah.
And he was always around. He was a colourful character, Andrew.
Andrew. Actually, having thought about that, you know, that building, the New Hibernia House, wasn't Andrew's.
Ah.
It was the place next door where you were that was Andrew's.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. But, of course, you know, we knew him from back in the day.
Oh, OK. Yeah. So he was always around and he took on the building.
That's right. Yeah.
And then... Yes, as we, this is sort of leading up to Morris in a way, because, yes, he had this vacant space in a coal cellar in the basement of the building next door, which you refer to, and that became the dining room.
The dining room. Yeah.
Which sort of lasted for sort of like 12 years, and Morris was the frequent visitor, even though you apparently remember Morris from his... as I do, because I first met him as a dispatch rider.
Absolutely.
Riding around Covent Garden with his tabard for heated clothing.
Yeah.
And you will also remember him pottering around.
Yeah, absolutely. Covent Garden. He used to park himself outside Covent Garden Tube Station, if you remember.
Right.
Handing out his leaflets and eating his freshly heated beans.
Yes.
From a can.
Yeah.
And at that time, we had another Andrew Chakowski connection. It was that we'd... We took on this shop on James Street, just down the road from the Tube Station, which became PX.
Right.
That was 1978.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Which also was, I mean, Covent Garden was pretty underdeveloped.
Well, that was another ex-fruit and veg market where they'd all been moved out to Vauxhall,
right,
and to the new Covent Garden.
Yeah.
And so that whole district was completely empty.
Yeah.
And Andrew just dived in there very quickly and just took a lease on that building, and he let it to he had it as rehearsal space for bands.
Oh, really?
And there was
okay.
all sorts of little punk bands that used to play up there and rehearse upstairs. And then myself and Steph Rayner and Helen Robinson and Rick Carter, we took on the ground floor and made it into a little fashion boutique.
Was Jack
PX.
Not involved?
Jack was always involved.
Yes.
He was always around.
Right. I see, but he wouldn't have been sort of like on the board of directors as such. He probably neatly evaded that, I should think.
No, it was a very... I don't know.
It wasn't a cooperative.
No, it wasn't a cooperative, no. I don't know. It was just something that we all decided to do. And, of course, Jack was around, but Jack had a job. So at that time wasn't he working at International Exchange?
Oh, the telephone exchange.
A telephone exchange, yeah.
But he'd go touring with you, wouldn't he?
Absolutely. No. He was very useful. Got us out of the ship many times with because he spoke Dutch and French.
Right, OK. All right. So then you moved to New Hibernia House and you started to hire out clothes to the film and TV industry?
We'd started doing that back in Belgravia, actually.
Right.
We sort of outgrew that place and the owners got wind of what we were doing and wanted us out. And so we moved out and we got this place in New Hibernia House.
Right.
And... It was the beginnings of contemporary wardrobe.
Right.
We were there for, I don't know, 5-8 years maybe.
Right. Strangely, because we started with the clock and you mentioning Edgar Lustgarten and Time to Remember, and we seem to be kind of winding our way back.
Mm.
And this has drawn me back to the World's End shop, which, as it happens, has a clock face outside it, which is whizzing backwards.
Exactly. It's got 13 numerals.
Has it?
Yeah.
I've never noticed that. Okay.
Yeah.
So that was the shop of Vivian Westwood.
That was indeed. And in fact, that was an interest. Well, I mean, the shop has always been, 430 Kings Road has been, you know, a landmark since the 60s.
Yeah.
No, there was another little Jack connection there because I remember being in New Hibernia House and receiving a phone call from Jack at some point one evening saying he'd just been drinking with Vivian Westwood on the King's Road, and she really liked the design that I'd done on PX in Covent Garden, and would I be interested in meeting her to talk about designing their new shop, which would be World's End on the King's Road.
Right.
So, of course, I was there like a shot.
Right.
And, I designed the shop for them there. And then a couple of years later went on to do another shop for them called Nostalgia of Mud, which was in St. Christopher's Place.
So was the first shop's of dictionaries?
The first of Vivian shops.
No, the first one that you did for...
No, I didn't do seditionaries. No, it was called World's End.
It's still called World's End.
Yeah.
But surely I gutted
seditionaries.
But Nostalgia of Mud surely preceded the Whizzing Clock.
No. Nostalgia of Mud was after...
But the clock remains.
No, it's a different place.
It's a different place. Oh, okay.
World Ends is...
So
430
is the 430 Two different
Road.
Shops, okay.
But then... A couple of years after doing the World's End shop, I was asked to do another shop for them in St. Christopher's Place called Nostalgia of Mud.
Okay, all right. Mm. So the clock that whizzes backwards, which is still there, it must have gone.
Indeed.
How long has it been there now, that clock?
Well, since 1979.
Right. Yeah. So and that was your idea, which the whole floor inside was all topsy-turvy. It was a bit like sort of Alice in Wonderland, wasn't it?
That's right, it still is, yeah. Yeah, I mean, we kind of had a brainstorming session for a couple of days, Malcolm and Vivian and myself, around at Vivian's flat in Clapham. And, you know, they'd got various ideas, and it was Malcolm's idea to do this clock, and then it was my idea to do the 13 numerals and,
right.
you know, it going backwards and stuff.
Okay.
And it actually, that clock idea came from a Hogarth print.
Oh.
Which is that there is a quite a famous Hogarth print with a clock on it, and it's got a signpost saying World's End on it.
Oh really? Oh, how funny! I never knew that. Okay. Yeah. That's interesting.
And then during the 70s, I spent most of my life driving around Britain looking for old dead stock clothing, vintage clothes and stuff to buy and sell and hire and do whatever. And I come across this this wonderful old pub in the Black Country called the Crooked House. And essentially there was a coal mine underneath it, and the whole thing had sort of subsided, but it had remained intact. But everything was the wrong way round. You know, the doors are going one way, and the floors are going another way, and the windows are going. And there were one of the, it's still there to this day, actually.
Okay.
Now it's a real landmark. You know, but at that time it was just like the locals used it. And the big tricks that the locals used to play on you, they would roll a bottle up a table instead of down the table.
Right.
And it was a total optical illusion because the window was facing the opposite way, and it was just, So I took this idea, and because we'd been talking about, you know, the old galleons and stuff, and they really liked this idea of having a sloping floor.
Right.
So...
Right.
That's what we did.
Okay.
Yeah.
So who made the clock?
The clock was made by a company, a special effects company that I worked with on a music video or something called. They were called Any Effects.
Oh right. Okay.
And they'd calculated how to work this clock backwards.
Right.
And it's still going today.
Yeah.
It's
amazing. Yeah. Time keeps going backwards.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, you could tell me a bit about your contemporary wardrobe days. What's been the highlight of your life in the film industry?
Highlight of my life in the film industry. I don't know whatever. You know, I mean, it was. There's been all sorts of stuff, really. Mm. I mean, how it started. I used to work, you know, with photographers and doing. Styling little shoots with photographers, which would end up in magazines or catalogues or whatever. And eventually I met up with this young film director called Julian Temple, who, had just done the great Rock and Roll Swindle.
Right.
And we kind of really shared an affinity and ended up, like, working together doing music videos, and at that time, it was the early 80s, and I was doing, like, art direction and costume and, well, whole production designs on some of these music videos and stuff, and lots of them for those new romantic bands at the time.
Right.
You know, Heaven 17 and Ultravox and Spandau Ballet and all those sort of people.
Yeah.
And... So that really took up like 5 years of my life, and then I sort of started to get more into film and stuff. And Julian's first film, or his first proper film, Absolute Beginners, which I was a co-designer of, and. And then, you know, doing commercials and other films and so on, and I mean, I've just been kind of constantly
right.
doing that.
So obviously there's a common thread here running through this whole thing, which is clothing and styling.
Absolutely, yeah.
And design.
Yeah.
Going right back to your time in the 60s, which has sort of come full circle in a way, because you recently hired out a lot of clothes to this mod exhibition in Leicester, which
That's
happened,
right.
yeah. which is sort of a bit like returning home in a strange way.
Yeah. I mean, it was that came out of the out of you know some old mod friends, as it were. One of the sons of an old mod friend, as in Joe Nixon,
right.
Who'd wanted to put this show together, and through you, actually, you put me in touch with Sean Knapp, who was writing a book about the music scene in the 60s. And
yeah.
Leicester was very, quite an important city in the 60s, amazingly.
Yeah.
It was a very rich city. It was the richest. Allegedly, it was the richest city in Europe in the 60s.
It's hard to understand
claim. Due to its...
what did they do with all that money?
Boot and shoe and hosiery and knitwear and stuff.
Yeah.
And so there was a very kind of strong fashion scene there, which I was very much a part of. And the mod scene, sort of, between 1963 and 66, and I never really kind of got over being a mod. I think, I mean, I think that was, and you know, that's how I really got interested in vintage clothes, because then I didn't really want to be a hippie, and the next thing to, you know, that was the next logical step after being a mod. But there was a group of. A small groups who were very into nostalgia clothing, and we used to follow this band called Family, who were a very famous Leicester band, and one as a publicity stunt, they started to wear these like 1930s suits and stuff that they got from secondhand clothes shops and
is that
so on.
Did they change their name to the Roaring Twenties or something?
They started off as life as Farinas. In fact, there was one before then. I think the name before then. But anyway, it's Farinas. Then it became the Roaring Twenties for about 5 minutes.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And then they became the Family, as in the Mafia Family. And they actually I don't know who got it together, but somebody managed to buy Dutch Schultz's limo from America, and they used to travel around in this thing as from gig to gig, dressed up in their kind of 1920s, 30s suits and stuff. And so we were all very that was what I sort of more got into at that time,
rather
than having long hair and being a hippie, and because I always liked the aesthetic of a suit, wearing a suit and so on.
Yeah.
So that was really, and that's when I started to collect stuff, really, to collect vintage clothes.
Right.
And then started to deal in them and trade and so on.
Strangely, the other day I went to the Courtauld Institute, and I was walking through the bookshop, and I was sort of arrested by this image on a glossy deluxe magazine, black and white photograph, which I thought, I know that face, and it was you, and it's sort of you nursing a figurine of Elvis Presley. What's that all about? What is that magazine? I can't remember.
What's it called?
It's quite a glossy sort limited edition fashion magazine, sort of, or it's a bit more broader than that, actually.
It's a sort of an archival magazine.
Yeah.
God, this is terrible.
It doesn't
matter. She used to work for me.
Oh, really?
And she did this. She does this. Basically, she just interviews collectors and archivists and so on, and people who have unusual. Hobbies, collections, whatever.
Okay.
And I was part of that thing.
Yes. Yeah. So was the drift of it the Elvis Presley figurine, or is it your whole collection?
Well, I think she'd really picked up on the fact that my first kind of crush was on Elvis Presley.
Oh.
When as a child.
Yes.
My sister was into rock and roll music, and her and her friends used to kind of play Johnny Ray constantly.
Oh.
And anyway, I got introduced to Elvis Presley and even joined his fan club and got the kind of the Elvis Presley pictorial come through the post, and you know it was but it was so dark you could hardly see any of the images, but I just loved him to death, and
all the
ink would come off on your fingers and anyway, whatever.
Okay.
But I've collected odd bits of Elvis ephemera and so on, and I've got this figurine.
Right. You're also very interested in dragsters, I think. Drag
racing? Yeah, very interested in drag racing and hot rods. Yeah, I've always had a big crush on those as well. Ever since I first started to learn how to drive. And I remember going to the first proper drag strip was in Northamptonshire.
Oh, really?
And it was called Santa Pod Raceway. And
I never knew it was so close to Leicester. I thought it was in the south somewhere.
No. It opened in 1966.
Oh.
And I went to, I think, the second meet there.
Oh, right.
And because I'd read about it in the newspaper saying, you know, cars going 100 miles an hour in a quarter of a mile.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, got to have a bit of this. So got in the car and drove over. And I've been going ever since. And now I go to strips, well, wherever they're, you know, I go to America or,
I'm still loving it. Because, in fact, we were going to play a track, weren't we? It was going to be the opening track by Big Stick.
That's right.
And the track is called A Threat.
Yes.
But then we played a bit of it before the show when we realised that there is expletives almost like every other word. It's like some kind of... and we thought, no, we can't play that, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Perhaps you could give me the drift of this track.
These two crazy characters from New England called Big Stick, and they have this thing called Drag Racing Underground. Basically, throughout the 80s, they would kind of go around the drag strips in America recording the sounds of loud cars revving and so on, and then make it into music. And And they became very impassioned by this, you know, by drag racing, and it just became, you know, that was their thing basically, and the big stick refers to the shifter, you know, the gear stick, as it were, big stick,
right?
And and so this particular track, A Threat, which seemed quite pertinent to me to play,
yes,
was about the government trying to close down a drag strip.
Oh, okay.
And they were sort of singing about it, basically. And I thought it was quite pertinent.
Yes. No, it's a nice track. I would have played it, but it's just I think we're bound by some sort of, you know, bylaw or something that says no, you can't do this before midnight or something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, all right. So what kind of car have you got now? I think you've got some kind of. I've just
spent my life savings on a 1940 Ford coupe, which I've been. These two fanatics have been kind of working on for the past 2 years now, which is finally finished. But it's very fast and very loud,
right?
And very bright red 1940
right
hot rod.
It is a hot rod.
It is a hot rod, indeed.
Can you drive it on the street?
Oh, yeah.
Do you drive it on the street?
I have done, yes.
What's your day car?
My other car is a bike. Cycle. Yes.
Right, okay. So would you take it to Santa Pod? Would it compete in such
I might do at some point, it'd be good to see how fast it would go. It would be quite interesting to do. Yeah.
It's not one of these with the exposed engine, is it?
No.
Can you do that? Is that legal these days?
You can do pretty much whatever you want. This is classed as a historical vehicle, being 1940.
Well, one of my favourite films is Custom Car Commandos, of course, the Kenneth Anger film, with the guys with the sort of powder puffs polishing the hot rod.
Yeah, that was a 32 Ford, yes.
Is it? Yes, yes. Oh, so that's not so far removed from your...
No.
Yeah,
working man's car.
Right. This was the
1940 style. The one you're referring to in Custom Car Commandos, the 32, that had a flat top.
Right. Okay. Oh, yes. Yeah.
And evidently Henry Ford, they wanted to bring out a new style of car. And his son designed it, but he said the only thing it's got to have room for a guy to be able to wear his cowboy hat in it, because most of my customers are farmers. And so it's got a hump top. It's got what they call a turret top.
Interestingly, this throws me back once again to Richard Bilson, of course, who I remember having something like a standard 10 in Leicester, and he had a sort of bouffant haircut, which I could imagine. I used to sort of imagine him sort of trying to get into this car without it ruining his bouffant haircut. But that's a complete aside. We should move back to the present time, perhaps. Let's get on to the horse hospital, Roger.
Yes.
I don't know, when did it start?
The horse hospital started. Well, we found somebody who was working for me at the time. I sent out to try and a guy called Guy Adams, actually, who's working for me again at the moment as our press person. Anyway, we were in Great Queen Street in Covent Garden, back in Covent Garden, and had a nice little place there. But the lease expired, and the owners wanted to get us out, and so I'd sent Guy for a bit of a hunt around up into Bloomsbury, because I knew there was always garages to let down this little musical colonnade, and he came back very excitedly to say that he'd found this building that looked like it was derelict. Would I go and have a look at it? And so we went back, and it was managed to find the owners of it, and got a key. It was in a right old state. I mean, it was derelict. It had been empty for like 10 years at least.
Yeah.
And there was pigeons flying about. There was rats everywhere. There was the half of the roof had caved in. There was this sticky substance on the floor that we. It was like glue. It's like walking through glue, up and down these ramps. It's got internal ramps for the horses. And
did you know it was a horse?
Well, no. It had been rumoured. We'd spoken to somebody in the pub. Opposite the friend at hand, and somebody there had evidently done a history of the area, and they found out they certainly knew it was stables, and it was rumoured to be a horse hospital, and anyway, so we ended up. I didn't really want to take a lease on it because it was too much of a project, but I ended up doing it, and we managed. I think we got 6 months free. Rent or something to be able to clear it out and make it habitable, and it took us a year actually to make it habitable. But it was a great space to house all my clothes in. By this time, you know, it was probably 15,000-20,000 items of vintage clothing that I was regularly hiring out to film and fashion and TV and so on. So it was a great space for that. But of course, that would only really required one floor of this building. This is a two-floor building. Hmm. And so we thought, okay, well, let's, you know, utilise the other floor. Maybe we could hire it out to photo shoots or whatever. Hmm. And then I thought, oh, okay, well, maybe, you know, to announce our presence, because if anybody's ever been to the Horse Hospital of your you know, your listeners, they'll know that there are no windows, and well, there are windows, but you can't see in, and so it's not like shop windows.
No.
So, whereas in Covent Garden we had shop windows and people knew what we were doing, so we decided to have this exhibition of punk clothing, going back to Vivian Westwood, you know, quite a considerable amount that I'd collected over the years, and friends, and so on and so forth. And we started this, we set up this exhibition called Vive Le Punk, and advertised it everywhere, all and sundry, and people very interested. And I think the opening night we had 500 people come to it, and among those people were was a lady from Japan who'd was part of the Shiseido organization, who are a sort of big cosmetic company, but in all they give something back to their clientele, and they've got a gallery in Tokyo, which is a free space, and she immediately said to me, we have to do this in Tokyo. So later on that year, I ended up going out to Tokyo doing that, and forming quite a long relationship with fashion houses over there, and styling fashion shows and putting on exhibitions and so on.
Was that the occasion when Malcolm and Vivian sort of got together again for the first time after several years?
Indeed, yes. Yeah, well, how that came about, that was quite interesting. Because when I first had this idea of putting on this show, I immediately called up Vivian and said, could she lend us anything for the show? And you know, would she endorse it, basically? And she said, oh, we'd be happy to endorse it. And, you know, she got one of two things, a pair of old boots that she used to chain together and walk down the King's Road in, and a couple of fluffy tops and things. And I said, well, it'd be great, you know, if you could come along and sort of, you know, be a part of it. And she said, oh, no, I don't want anything to do with it. You know, it's just, that's the past. And, you know, I'm over, you know, teenagers now and punk and all the rest of it.
Right.
So I approached Malcolm in much the same way, who was at that time living in Paris and recording with, I don't know, Francois Hardy or somebody. And he was very much of the same, you know, opinion. You know, he endorsed it, but he didn't really want to be involved with it. But as the stuff was coming in, because basically I had quite a decent collection, but I also got in touch with, you know, lots of other people that I knew had collections, like Marco Peroni and Keith Wainwright and so on, and they all kindly loaned stuff for the show.
Right. I should just interject to say, I mean, for anyone that's under the age of 30, we should clarify that we're talking about Malcolm McLaren and Vivian Westwood.
Oh, yeah, no, totally.
No, it's all right. It's my fault as well. We just keep referring to Malcolm and Vivian as though everyone knows who they are.
So as the stuff was coming in, and we were cataloguing it and, you know, hanging it up and displaying it and so on, it rapidly became apparent to me that we were just about got an example of pretty much everything that they'd ever designed from between 1971 and 1978. And so I thought, well, okay, well, this is really important that Vivian comes and sees this, because, you know, I mean, she wasn't as famous then, and it might be, you know, she might never ever see it all together again, you know. So I kind of kept on at her, and she was, no, she didn't really want to. She was in the middle of doing a fashion show and blah, blah, blah. So I got on to Malcolm McLaren in Paris, and again, and eventually he agreed to come. But he said, "I'm not going to come to the opening, but I'll come the night before, and I'll have a look at it." Yeah.
Right.
And so I thought, well, if I can get him, then I'm going to get her.
Right.
And so I went back to calling her up and her PA and so on and so forth. And eventually she agreed. She said, I'll come if Malcolm's not coming. And I said, no, he's not coming. lying through my teeth. Oh. And anyway, he turned up about, I don't know, 7 o'clock in the evening. You were there.
I took photographs. Yeah.
And
I've got sort of about 6 photographs of the two of them together.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
And immediately Malcolm started talking about a particular T-shirt, the Cambridge Rapist T-shirt, which had caused a lot of controversy.
Yes.
And how he Bernie Rose had printed it really badly and so on and so forth. And so we asked, I asked him if he wouldn't mind being filmed, and he said, yeah, that's fine. So we started to film him. And then after a few minutes, the buzzer rang and Vivian appeared at the door.
Wow.
And we both sort of turned around and said, oh, hello, Vivian, you know. And I thought, oh, God, what am I going to do? So I said, oh, would you like a cup of tea, Vivian? And she sort of, like, silence. And she said, no, I'll have a double brandy. Oh. So we send out for a double brandy across the pub, and she stood in the doorway chain smoking and drinking this double brandy for while Malcolm went on about I designed this and I designed that and so on. And eventually she joined in the conversation,
right,
particularly when they were talking about their son Joe, who'd had a toy car that he'd run over a T-shirt with some printing ink on the wheels and made these tire tracks, and they really liked that idea and so on. And anyway, we filmed this whole thing, and we actually have just over an hour's worth of footage of them talking, and it is the only known footage of them ever talking about that their collaboration together, in those punk shops.
Yeah. Okay. What format is the film on?
Oh, we have it digitized, and we screen it from time to time.
Oh, do you? Okay.
Yeah. We just screened it just before Christmas, actually.
Uh-huh.
And Jordan, who used to work for Malcolm and Vivian, Jordan Mooney, she came along and, you know, we did a bit of a talk together about it.
Uh-huh.
And her time, you know, working with them.
Right, right, right. So that was your first show there then? The Vive la Punk was your first
opening? Vive la Punk was the very first show, yeah.
Right.
And it was really successful, and we thought, okay, well, let's carry on. And we did another one, a photographic show was the next one, was about skinhead culture. Mm-hmm. Basically, I was very into. I'd got a commission from a publisher at the time to write a book about street fashion,
right?
And I wanted to do a series of shows that I could then use in the book and so forth.
Right.
And so it made sense to do that.
Right.
And then my wife Isabel, who'd previously been designing evening dresses, she decided to go back to university to Chelsea College of Art, and she did sculpture there. And their degree show, I think it was, they asked if they could show their work at the Horse Hospital. And so we formed a sort of relationship with Chelsea and then other universities and so on. And it's gone on from there, really. And it just, you know, it was one of those things that it was a great use of the space. It brought people to the space. It gave it life.
Right.
And it was at a time when, you know, I was still interested in doing things and going out and stuff, but there was nowhere I really wanted to go to. So I thought, okay, well, I'll create my own little event-based to do right. things.
Yeah.
And if, you know, I've just put on stuff that I like and hopefully yeah. other people will like it too. And
yeah.
eventually other people started to come and we started doing film screenings. And
so what is the you've got something called the Chamber of Pop Culture. Is that part
well,
of it?
Well, we called it the Chamber of Pop Culture as a sort of as an ironic dig into pop culture.
Yeah,
you
I
know,
see.
It
was, okay. It's not a separate space. It's the whole thing. It's an umbrella thing.
It's definitely not
Does it
popular
make money?
Culture. No, of course not.
No. So is it shored up by your contemporary wardrobe?
It's totally supported by contemporary wardrobe and... Yeah. You know, kind people who donate stuff and put on events, yeah. and we raise a little bit of money through that and through hiring the space out to book launches.
Okay.
And,
so what's the issue? You've been under threat now for quite some time. I mean, last year there was a perhaps it's always been a crisis. I don't know. Last year there was a particular crisis when you were under threat.
Yeah, we've been under threat three times basically since we've been there. In the year 2000, the owners wanted to sort of get us out, but we wanted to stay, and we managed to get the building listed with English Heritage Grade 2 listed.
Ah.
Or Historic England, or whatever it's known as now. And then 5 years ago, I suddenly got an... they went quiet after that, the owners. And then 5 years ago, I got a letter from them saying that they wanted to sell the building. And they wanted me to...
Who is they?
The owners of the building. They're a family in Wales.
Oh.
The Evanses.
Okay. Right.
And
so they own the freehold.
They own the freehold. They own quite a few properties in the Mews.
Right. Okay.
Their grandfather bought about 20 or 30 properties in London back in the 1920s when it was all tuppence. And these are the grandchildren and they've sort of inherited it and and they want to capitalize on their assets basically. So 5 years ago, they decided that they were, because they got me as a sitting tenant, it was a listed building, and they thought, well, they would get rid of it. And I said, well, I don't want to go. You know, I built up a business here.
Yeah.
We have a very, very strong international following in art, film, and so on and so forth, and I don't want to go. And so... We then had a big public meeting, and what happened was there were some great suggestions, but one of the main things that came up was that we should try and get it listed as a community asset.
All right.
Well, we couldn't do that ourselves. We had to get the community to do it, but there was more than enough people in the community who formed a little group called the Friends of the Horse Hospital.
Oh, right.
And they put an application into the council, Camden Council, who have always been very good to us, and they sort of pushed it through, and so it got listed as a community asset. So that was another kind of thing that a stumbling block for the owners, because they then, you know, it was something else, another reason not to get rid of it. So they decided they weren't going to get rid of it. And then again, it all went quiet until last year when I suddenly got a blitz of phone calls and emails saying, the building, we are terminating the lease, basically.
Oh, wow. Right.
Which evidently they're allowed to do by law.
Was the lease coming to an end?
It's one of those old-fashioned leases within the Landlords and Tenants Act, which is no longer relevant in today's whatever. So it afforded us a great deal of protection, but. Because we could never agree the terms of a new lease outside of the Landlords and Tenants Act, which we tried to negotiate several times, they decided that okay, we've been in this holding over situation
right.
for like, you know, 10 or 15 years.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And the only way to get out of that is to terminate it. And
right.
So that's what they've done.
Oh, they've done it.
They've terminated the lease, and we were due to get out on December the 25th.
Oh, okay.
We've had to negotiate for extra time because we are still trying to negotiate a fair rent. Basically, they're now saying, "Oh, yes, no, we really want you to stay there." However, we want to.
Who's saying this? Evans or the council?
Evans
are saying they still want you to stay there.
They want us to stay there and negotiate.
But what do they want? Just
lease,
more rent then.
But they want to quadruple the rent.
Okay. Quadruple it, literally.
Oh, yeah. Literally, yes. Yeah. Yeah. From 30,000 to 130,000. That's what they want.
Oh.
I think it's 400.
So that, of course, is impossible, I presume.
It's totally ridiculous.
Yeah. Is that the going rate? Is that like the sort of, you know, when it's assessed, does somebody say, you know, this is what it should be for this? Or can they just come up with an arbitrary figure?
They've based it on other properties that they've got per square footage, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. Not really taking into account that we have no amenities there whatsoever. You know, there's like one toilet, no kitchen, there's no...
Yeah.
You know, there's no heating. The place is freezing cold. Well, you know what it's like.
It's still a horse hospital.
It is really still a horse hospital. It's just that we have the perfect use for it, really.
Right.
And,
so, is there any leeway? Is there a negotiating sort of possibility?
We have tried, and we're still trying. Our lawyers and surveyors are trying to get them down as much as possible and get me.
But if they met halfway, if they sort of said, "Well, we'll do whatever it is, 65,000," is that still?
It would still be too much.
Too much,
really.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, what
yeah.
are you hoping for then? First of all, you really want to stay there.
Of course,
you want to carry on doing this thing.
Yeah, I really want to. I mean, it's a great space. Yeah. I love that space. Yeah. I've made that space.
Yeah.
It was like I said before. It was derelict. It was.
Yeah.
Nobody was interested in it. And yeah, I mean, it's very easy to look at it through rose-tinted glasses and say, "Oh, yeah, this is like prime location in central London." Blah de blah. It's a horse hospital, for God's sake. It's an empty space. It's only what we've given it that has given it life that has made it into something.
Right.
So,
and of course, presumably, whatever they do with it would be far less interesting. It would probably just become, you know, a living space or something. And so,
I think they're very restricted as to what they can do with it. Oh. To be honest,
okay.
You know, because of the because obviously everything in the building is listed, in particular the floors and the ramps, which are all kind of higgledy-piggledy and sort of sloping the wrong way, and there's gutters
like
and so
end.
On.
Like,
well, yeah. Precisely.
you go from and, one floor to another. Though,
yeah. And they can't, they can't do away with that stuff.
No.
And
so what's the state of play, Roger? Where do you go from
here? The state of
here?
Play is that we've got now until February the 28th. To negotiate.
Right.
We are asking for people to support us, letters of support that can be sent to the owners and hoping that they'll kind of
And how would they get
sense.
To, how would they get that?
That
address,
can be done through the through our website. If they
through
go
the
to horse. The horse hospital website, there is all the information is there, and there's even a template of you know what you want to write, you know, of the way various people have sent in their support letters. I mean, the Mayor of London has supported us.
Which one?
Sadiq.
Okay,
the Mayor.
You sure?
Mayor of London.
All right.
And
that's me. That's my aberration.
Okay.
I had to suddenly think who is the Mayor of London.
And Camden Council have supported us. They've all written letters of support.
Yeah.
All the universities, because we, you know, not only people who are just kind of interested in weird fashion and art and so on. But, you know, all the universities use it for...
Right.
They have shows there. They
so it is,
they come
it's
along
a,
as
it's
a
cultural asset. Then.
Absolutely,
it's something on
totally.
The, on, I mean, there's a long list of people that have performed there, shown films there. You have three times, in fact, lent the premises to a Resonance as for fundraising activities. I've staged three things there actually, for no money, just to raise funds for Resonance. So, so there has been a kind of a reciprocal kind of... I mean, is there anything that people can do then, apart from some billionaire listening to it and saying, OK, I'll buy the property for you? what's the...
Well, we've got a little donation box, you know, in, again, on the website. Right. They can chuck a few quid in if they can. You know, it's all, at the moment, it's all going towards legal costs, which are going to be ridiculous. I mean, essentially, if we can't agree... a fair rent between us, then we're going to have to go to court and then, you know, plead our case, as it were. But
so that, do you have a legal case then? You can stay as sitting tenants?
Yeah, we do.
Oh, okay. I see, okay. But so then the compromise situation would be somebody would adjudicate on what the correct rent should be. You might get a reduced rent, possibly, and then you'd take it from there. So you can sort of...
But, I mean, taking it to court's going to cost a fortune. Oh. And if we lose, then we're going to have to pay their bill as well.
Oh,
so
God.
It's just... It's not a great position to be in, to be honest.
Right.
And
and the clock is ticking. It's not
the clock is ticking. And I mean, I hate to say it, but... I think, you know, a lot of people think we're crying wolf because this has happened so many times before. But but this really is, you know, this really could be the end.
Right. Mm. Would you, might you consider moving to another premises, or would it just not be the same thing?
I would never find somewhere as interesting as
that's for sure.
Central London. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'd be in blooming... Staines or somewhere, Slough, or which I'm not that really interested in.
No,
I mean, it. You know, we've had a really good run. We've had 27 years.
Yeah.
We've made a bit of a statement. We protected the building.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if we have to leave, then fine. We've had a great time.
Right. Yeah. But you're not resigned to leaving, that's for sure.
Absolutely not.
No,
I'm going to fight it out to the last.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. Today's guest was Roger Burton from making the case for the Horse Hospital, which is situated behind the Russell Hotel WC1. Anything coming up soon? What's the next event that people might... I note that Jeremy Reed's playing there at some point, isn't he?
Yeah, Jeremy Reed is a regular, a regular there, and we've got at the moment we've got a punk clothing exhibition, and there is another show opening probably our last show, which is opening on I think it's February the 6th, and it features Mark Harmond.
Oh, really? Mm. When was that? That's February the 6th, you say? OK, well, thank you very much, Roger, for coming in. And we had a whole stack of records that we thought we might play, but I just thought we'd just keep on talking.
Absolutely.
I mean, it would have stopped the flow, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
that's
good.
We've got a sort of stack of CDs and various things, but we can play out with one of your choices, which is the Art Ensemble of Chicago from this classic CD, and this is the theme de Yo-Yo. Is this a particular favourite of yours?
It is indeed, yeah.
Okay.
I've always loved them. Thank you.
to blind eagles that kill what they can't see. Your hands are like to...
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.